Hi, welcome to episode 116 of the Bobbycast. This guest is Scott Hamilton, who won the Olympic gold back in 1984. We talk about adopting. And by the way, and Amy's in here for this pre thing, because I'm doing the pre-show before. But yeah, and we talk about you in this coming up podcast, because his wife is your mentor.
Yes, because they adopted two older kids from Haiti, and so did we. So they've been a huge help to us.
So not only is it super inspirational, but it gets really cool too, because we start talking about, I don't want to ruin it, but when he came back, he said overnight, he was nobody. He came back from the Olympics, and they had 5,000 people waiting for him.
Crazy.
It's crazy. So Scott Hamilton, and the first time I knew of Scott Hamilton, I wasn't alive. I guess I was alive, but I was.
We were so little.
I was so little. I don't know him from that, but I know him from something else, and that's what I told him. You'll hear it. This is episode 116 of the Bobbycast. He has a book called Finish First, Winning Changes Everything. Other podcasts to check out include Velvet's Edge with Kelly Henderson. Her latest episode's up with Amy, which is why I have Amy here.
Yep.
You guys could talk about all kinds of stuff, huh?
Everything.
Even me.
Bobby, yes, you were discussed.
There we go. Mm-hmm. There's also Good Company with Jake Owen. Jake's got a podcast. He's got a funny one with his mom. And then Geeking Out with Christian Bush. Upcoming guests of this here include Kimberly Schlattman from Little Big Town, Jason Aldean, writer Jesse Frazier, Ashley Gorley.
Yeah.
I feel like there's somebody else, too, we're forgetting. That's coming. That's a big deal. A lot of people coming by. So there you go. This is episode 116. Tell your friends about the Bobbycast if you like it. This is Scott Hamilton. All right, welcome to another episode of the Bobbycast with Scott Hamilton. someone that, you know, it's been cool for me getting to know you over the past couple of years. You've been on the show a couple times. You were introduced into my personal life through Amy.
Yes. Yeah.
And through her adoption process. She calls your wife her mentor, you know.
Yeah, it's almost like sister in crime. You know, it's a tough process, you know, that navigating all the politics and, you know, just the enormity of what international adoption is, especially in Haiti. I mean, that's a complicated place.
We were talking about it this morning, Amy and I were, and I had mentioned seeing Tracy, your wife, and I can say her name, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm making sure. And she was like, yeah, Tracy's my mentor. She's been my mentor through the adoption process. And it was the first time I'd heard Amy describe her as that. I knew that you guys had helped, and that's how I've gotten to know you guys. But I didn't know that she actually considered her like the person that she looked up to.
Well, I think when you're doing something like that, especially, you know, Amy and Ben went from zero to two older kids. You know, they don't get them as babies. It's, you know, there's a lot of challenges that come with that. Kids are imprinted wherever they are, and that's their behavior, that's their code. And then when you got language barriers and everything else, you need somebody that's going to stand with you in a situation like that, you know, who's kind of been there, done that. And I think Tracy's really been, I think it means a lot to Tracy to be able to offer that to Amy, just getting through it. And there's tough days, you know, even if it's perfect, right? And, you know, birth children and, you know, we brought them up since, you know, you're going to have those bumpy parts. And, you know, we've seen that all the way through with not only our two birth children, but our two adopted children from Haiti. It's a wild ride. And, you know, I've lived through enough where I can kind of like, you know, live with more of an open hand and say, okay, that wasn't a great choice. let's talk that one, you know, through a little bit. And, you know, Tracy's much more, you know, direct and, you know, we're going to take this, nip it in the bud, and move on. And it's like, okay, you're the boss.
Well, listen, I'm glad you're here. You and Tracy are super nice. But, you know, you have such an interesting life. And, you know, the first time I was introduced to you, see, I was born in the 80s, so I didn't get to see you win the gold medal in 84.
I own the 80s.
Right. Well, but you know how I was introduced to you was watching you come in at the end of Roseanne.
Yeah.
And whenever you were doing the sock skating on in the kitchen.
Well, I still get a check every month for about 34 cents, you know, in residuals for that.
And that was the first, that's when I started actually looking you up and being like, who is this Scott Hamilton guy?
Oh, it was so much fun. You know, I was really working too hard and there was all this crazy stuff going on. And I got a call from Roseanne saying, we want to do linoleum sock skating. And it's like, I'm in. Well, we want to get Vern Lundquist. He's in. Do you think we should ask him first? I go, no, he's in. And so Vern was really happy to do it. And then I got Kevin Quinn and I did that skit. And I kept running to Kevin all over the place. And he was a really neat guy. You know, he had a lot of demons that, you know, ended up taking him. But we had a really nice friendship. And it was really funny doing that because Roseanne's like, that's not funny. Don't do that. No, that do something. And so, yeah, it was their last show before they broke for Christmas, and there was a big party afterwards. And
did you go to the Roseanne party?
Yeah.
They let you go?
It was fun, yeah.
What happens at the Roseanne Barr rap party? Because that was when the show was really kicking it its first time, like really doing great.
It was awesome. You know, everybody was, you know, Johnny Galecki was there, and then I ended up with John Goodman. That was back, you know, a long time ago, and I occasionally might misbehave a little bit. And I ended up sitting with him like for hours and laughing because there's a guy that works with Dick Button named Dennis Grimaldi, and Dennis gave John his start in skating. So we had that, you know, I had Dick Button on my skating side and he had Dennis Grimaldi on the acting side, and we just sat there and just laughed about all the crazy stories of those guys and all the partnership and all the shows they produced. And a lot of people don't know that, you know, Dick Button created Superstars.
The Superstars, which is the show.
With that athletic competition where they'd put all the people from all the different sports together, all competing one-on-one.
I don't remember that show.
Oh, my God. It was huge. And Battle the Network Stars, he did
now,
that one.
I've seen some Battle the Network Stars on YouTube.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm dating myself a bit. I don't
know. Well, I'm dating myself a lot of bit.
So but when was Superstars on?
It was in the 70s and 80s. Okay. And they would bring in people from baseball, football, boxing, basketball, soccer, and they'd all compete against each other in these kind of more Olympic kind of sports. And it was really entertaining, and the ratings were huge. And people thought, oh, that's Dick Button created that. And, you know, Dennis was a big part of Dennis's theatrical side. And John Goodman and I had that in common. It was fun. It was a big night.
It's funny you bring up ratings and television shows. From back, even when I was a kid, there were five or six outlets. And so everything had a lot of eyeballs. Where now there's a million outlets and yeah. You're fighting for a few eyeballs on all of them.
It's been tough. You know, when you look at terrestrial kind of networks, you know, and it was ABC, CBS, and NBC, and they owned everything. And they were burning through money, and it was kind of this gigantic, huge, you know, infrastructure that just, they just printed money. It was just gigantic. And then cable television came through, and the network guys, from the way I understand it, were kind of stiff-armed and saying, no, we got this. If you want to come on, then you're going to have to pay. You know, we're not going to pay you. You're going to have to pay to get on our systems. And it was like, wait, 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 that's not fair. And then all of a sudden, there was all these choices. And network television now is a completely different business model than it was before. I mean, they still have a lot of money and they still have a lot of eyeballs, but it's not nearly what it was back when. I mean, we had three stations when I was growing up, and here's how old I am. We waited till 6 o'clock when the NBC went from black and white to color.
Wait, so television did that?
And that's where the Peacock was so amazing, because they would do, the Peacock would, all of a sudden, all the colors would come on and it'd be this, wow. And, you know, my parents were really big into, like, they loved music and as professors in school, they loved music and they loved television. They loved, you know, media. And so we had this big kind of console in our living room where we had a color TV, and it was awesome. And we just sit there and stare, and all the shows that we used to watch back then were just so much fun.
I didn't know, and I consider myself a TV nerd. I didn't know it went from color or from black and white to color in the middle of the day.
Like, yeah, it was right at prime time. Yeah, it was usually, I guess, right before the news. You know, sometimes the news is in black and white.
Remember when the news was important?
Yeah.
Like, the news is on, well, and it's still a thing.
But no, the news kind of isn't news anymore. It's opinion. It's all these opinion chat shows, right? Where
you're talking about cable news.
Yeah, I'm talking about...
I'm talking about the local news.
Yeah.
The local news used to be a big deal.
If it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah. The weatherman... I'm from Arkansas. A tiny Arkansas town. And the weatherman in Arkansas, when I was a kid, was named Ned Permy.
Mm-hmm.
He's still there, and I'm starstruck by the local Little Rock weather guy. Yeah. Because the TV, local TV news was such a big deal where I grew up. Where did you grow up?
Bowling Green, Ohio.
Okay, so that's not a big city.
No, it was really small. Like, the joke about Bowling Green is it's in that really flat part of Ohio. You can actually stand in a chair and see Detroit, Michigan. You know, it's that flat. And really, you know, it's a lot of farm country. It was a university center. So the population was kind of like a third college families, a third locals, and a third in agriculture. And it was a really odd mix growing up. And but, you know, it was still rooted in the college. And so everything we did was kind of at the university, and all the fun things. Like, the ice arena was part of the university, and And that's where we got started there. But it's a great way to grow up. You know, we had big weather, huge weather, tornadoes coming through there all the time. And I remember just be home before the tornado hits.
So yeah, right.
Pushing my bike because I couldn't ride it into the wind. And it was awesome. It was really fun to grow up that way.
You got a new book, Finish First, Winning Changes Everything. It came out back in February.
Mm-hmm.
And so tell me what this overarching, because I've read most of it at this point. Tell me what this overarching theme of Finish First is.
Well, you know, I've been doing a lot of speaking, a lot of, you know, and I've done a couple books. And I was, you know, I really wanted to, you know, I felt there was something in there that needed, you know, to come out that was a new platform for me to share. And I sat down with Donald Miller, who's an author, and I just said, you know, what's my next message? And he goes, winning. Okay, I figured that one out. But what do you mean? He goes, we live in a time where everything is based on participation trophies and sparing our, you know, sparing everybody's feelings, and we don't want to do this one, do that. And I really feel like we're in trouble. And you know, competition is good. Competition allows us. You know, I mean, you hear that every day. You're competing with all these other, you know, radio shows and
YouTube channels, radio shows,
everything. You're competing.
Spotify, everything. Yeah,
but it makes you better.
Yeah. I mean, metal still sharpens steel.
Yeah,
you know, and better things make me better.
Right.
Yeah.
So a lot of, you know, that has been pushed out of our culture. So we got, you know, a lot of people that are in business looking for, you know, how do I get better? How do I, you know, win the next job? Or, you know, people in school, how do I, you know, how do I put myself in a great position to succeed? And then you've got, you know, kids in sports. And I've even found the book has a big audience with senior citizens where they go, I was given up and now you've given me permission to kind of go do some things I've always wanted to do. So, you know, the whole idea behind Finish First is that, you know, we all have dreams, aspirations. We all have things that we want to do. We all have things that we need to do. You know, we all have purpose. We all have talents and skills that allow us to do things in a really special and remarkable way. But it doesn't just happen. You've got to, you know, roll up your sleeves and you know, put the time in to really advance your advance your skills, learn how to lose and win, and learn how to, you know, put yourself out there. And when you do, everything changes. You know, if you're able to, you know, build that foundation of a million different victories of just showing up, of just doing the work, of being, you know, leaving the last one to leave, and all those really great concepts of understanding that you're not quite who you need to be, and there's probably something in there just dying to get out. And it's taking stock of your skill set and what you're drawn to, and then being able to leverage that into something really significant. And I've always felt that when I see people that are kind of making bad choices, it's like,
It's crazy you mentioned that. This is not a plug for my book, but my book comes out in June, my second book. And I say it's the least uplifting motivational book ever.
It's, okay, now I have
and,
to read
and
it.
And it's a lot like, because I wrote my first book and I didn't really have interest in writing a book. I didn't. And I wanted to write a kid's book. And so I ended up, they said, hey, the kid's book, it's so saturated, that market.
No.
Said, don't write a kid's book, write a memoir. And I thought, what have I done? I haven't won a World Series or a gold medal or been on the moon. So I write this book, Scott. And yeah. I'm like, this is terrible. I think this is a turd.
That's one way.
Yeah, and it sells like unbelievably. Right? And so it's unbelievable to me. And I didn't want to write a second book. Just was not going to do it. So I did a TED Talk, and it was called "Winning by Losing."
Yeah, I saw it.
Okay, and so they said, "Hey, would you write that?" And I thought, that's about the only thing that interests me.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're saying is a lot of what I wrote in my book, and how it's if you can't do the little things like be on time.
Yeah.
Then you can't do the big things.
Yeah.
Like, stop begging to get the big jobs if you can't do the little jobs right.
Well, and it's also, you know, sometimes we, you know, I see people that are putting themselves in the wrong place. It's like, okay, I know you really want to do that. Like, I would love to be a rock star. All right. Too short, too bald, can't sing, can't play an instrument. Those are challenges. Those are big challenges. And it's, so it's like, you know, you find your way, you bump around and then you find things. You know, I like to tell a story of when I was in Korea for the Olympics, the venue manager there and I got to be really good friends. And he said, I want you to talk to my staff because a lot of the young Korean people have given up. They're just basically told to be obedient, do what we tell you to do, and you'll be fine. But don't, you know, it's like they're crushing dreams, basically, as a culture. And I gave my little, you know, spiel on Finish First. And then a girl came up to me and she was about 18, I guess. And she goes, I don't understand what you mean about purpose. And I go, really? I mean, what do you mean? And she goes, I'm not good at anything. And she said it just like that. And it's like, who's pouring into this girl that she's not good at anything? Yeah. And so I go, well, let's just break it down. I go, what do you like to do? What brings you joy? And she goes, I like to read. And I go, wow, what do you read? And she goes, well, the last two books I read were Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights. And I go, oh, you like the classics. And I finally got a smile out of her. And she goes, I do. And I go, maybe you're an author. And her eyes just popped. That's that little, like, you know, thing of recognition where like that. And it was like, I felt like I gave her permission to dream just for that second. And maybe it was a seed. I don't know. But it's just like there are so many people out there just looking for direction and looking for a path forward. And you know, they're stuck behind all these participation trophies. And we don't want anybody to win or anybody to lose. And that's just lazy parenting. You know, it's like when Max, my youngest, you know, a great kid, funny, you know, wants to be a great hockey player. He has Ryan Ellis's number on his back because he sees himself as Ryan Ellis, right? Because he's a little guy and he wants to play D and score and all that stuff. And he played his first few games and they got killed. I mean, they just got destroyed. And I'm like, buddy, what's wrong? And he goes, I don't like losing like this. I don't like it. And I go, okay. Well, what did you learn today? And he goes, well, I got to skate better and I got to stick handle a little bit better. And I want to get my shot up. I really want to hit that top corner of the net. And it's like, that's great, Max. What would you have learned if you won? And he looked at me like, is that a trick question? Because I don't have an answer. And that's it. I mean, if we can learn from losing, if we can look at losing as information and not this debilitating, horrible, painful scar on our psyche, we're probably going to be better off. It's like all the haters on Twitter, you know, during the Olympics, I got roasted a bunch. And so I put them all, not all, I put about seven of them in a talk I gave to this college leadership program. And when I started playing them one after another, these college kids were covering their eyes, covering their face. And it's like, are you kidding me? This is nothing. You know, because criticism comes down to, is it fact or is it opinion? If it's opinion, you can delete it right away. It doesn't mean anything. It's just noise or just nothing. And if it's fact, then now you have something to work with, right? And you can like totally figure out how to deal with that, you know, maybe is a weakness that you can worry about and really, you know, sharpen and get better at things, right? So when I was skating, Dick Button was always telling me how bad I was at this or how bad I was at that. And so my goal every year was to give him one less thing to talk about, to the point where if I made it to the Olympics in 84, he couldn't say anything bad about me. And that was it. It's like the greatest strength is a lack of weakness. Where are we weak? That's what we need to work on. And, you know, failure is information and criticism is edit it. Just edit it. And it's amazing how powerful that can be for people that fear taking that first step forward.
You know, part of your book is, and one of the things that resonated with me was you talk about editing your critics. I hope I'm saying that right.
Yeah. Edit your critics.
It's what you're talking about there. But when I was reading it, and that was a part to me that stuck out, and you just hit it. But that's what, when you're in the public eye, or you have a job that a lot of people see, it doesn't have to be a radio personality, it can be the head of an office.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people with a lot of opinions.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to edit what you're going to take in from them.
Yeah.
Because it'll melt you.
We have, right now in U.S. figure skating, there's a situation where you have as many as 12 judges coming to evaluate your skating. Now, if I were making chicken soup and I had 12 people working on the chicken soup, you know how edible that would be? It wouldn't be. It would be awful. And so, you know, I need to work with people on how we, you know, information, how it's given, and really make it so it's nutritious and not just a bunch of opinions going back and forth, because it confuses people. And these are people of authority. So, yeah, we have to really look at what the information is, how it's coming in, and how best we can utilize it. And if we can't, it's okay that I give you permission to throw it away, right? I had a judge tell me one time, an international judge, when I'm on that, just that little bit of a slope up, you know, I'm starting to kind of look like I'm going to actually be okay. And she said, it's really good that Scott's doing better, but he's too short to be competitive internationally. And I looked at that and I was like, how am I going to fix that? You know, it's like, what do you do with that? So I realized that that was just opinion, because I looked back in history, and there was a guy in 1960. His name was David Jenkins. He was my height. and he won the Olympics and 3 world championships. I go, if David Jenkins can do it, I'll probably be okay. It's just somebody's opinion. They don't maybe like short skaters, but hopefully she won't be on my panel and I'll be able to press on. And as it turns out, it was just one judge's opinion. And I could have allowed that to, you know, really slay me and knock me down and like, I might as well quit, you know, but it was one of those things where it's just, okay, that's good. I now know that I have permission to edit what anybody tells me so that I can look at it realistically and say, yeah, I need to work on that. Or that's just somebody's opinion. When you get on social media, none of those people would ever say it to your face. Okay, that's edit number one.
Finish first. Winning changes everything. Check out Scott Hamilton's book. Let me talk about one of our sponsors here for a second. It's hard to find a bigger fan of you than your mom. Through all the teenage mischief and tough first steps of adulthood, she's been there supporting you every step of the way. This Mother's Day, show her just how much you appreciate all of her dedication with 1-800-Flowers.com. Right now, when you get ahead of the Mother's Day rush, 1-800-Flowers is giving you an exclusive 24 for 24 offer. That's 24 multicolored roses for $24. That's only $1 per rose. That's right. Bright and beautiful mix of premium roses in a rainbow of colors. 24 multicolored roses for only $24. It is an amazing offer, but you have to hurry because it expires on Thursday. To order 24 stunning, that is, multicolored roses for $24, go to 1-800-Flowers.com, click the radio icon, and enter the code BONES. That's 1-800-Flowers.com. Enter the code BONES. Do it now. It's still probably before Mother's Day. You can still get this. 1-800-Flowers.com, and the promo code is BONES. So I have some things that I pulled. You know, it's funny. I've never Wikipedia'd you until this. I've only ever socially spoken to you or had
Wikipedia.
You come on the show.
Yeah.
But so I Wikipedia'd you, and Wikipedia is never right about me.
Yeah.
So yeah. I don't know how right Wikipedia is about you. But the thing that stuck out to me was, and I don't know if this is true or not, but you at the first World Championships you fell like 5 times. Is that true?
No, my first nationals I ever competed.
First nationals.
In. Yeah, I came in dead last. It was you know.
How old were you when this happened? Because I looked at this and went, the gold medal winner.
Yeah.
At one time.
No, I came
dead
in last a lot. No, a whole bunch. I came in dead last.
When?
Novice. My first nationals schedule the novice men, which is the lowest level event that goes to nationals. They scheduled it as the event right before the senior ladies championship. And the single most popular woman athlete in the world was Janet Lin. And it was her last nationals. So it was standing room only in this building.
Everybody was there.
Was there. And I never saw that many people in my life. I grew up in a town of 15,000. I skated in a town of 2,000 people. And there's 17,500 people in this packed auditorium. And I choked. I mean, I couldn't even feel my legs. I fell 5 times, came in dead last. And then I thought, okay, after I got done crying for like a week, I said, I'm going to go next year. I'm going to just show everybody what I'm made of. And next year I was 9th again, but there were 10 guys there. So I actually beat a guy. And so, you know, and I'm killing it on novice. You know, I might as well move up to the junior level because, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen? I can come in 9th again, right? And that summer, I got my double axel, which was a huge deal, and I actually beat 2 guys at nationals, so I was 7th. That's the best I could do.
You were 7th, but you were 7th at a higher class as well.
Well,
is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I found a way to beat 2 guys, right? And so the next year, my mom was diagnosed with cancer, and then she said, we're going to have to stop because we're broke, but we can get you through this year, but this is it. You're senior year in high school. You know, you can go out and just skate 1 more year and that's it. And then we have to stop because we're out of money. And I said, okay. So my main coach retired and a new coach came on board. He was kind of a slave driver. He had a big, long, very painful whip and he would crack it all the time. And I just decided I got nothing to lose. I might as well listen to this guy. And so I did everything he told me to do. And I worked really hard. And about 2 weeks before the Nationals, I landed my first triple. And he told me in the warm-up before the long program, he said, don't do it in warm-up. We don't want to know if it's there or not. Just throw it in the program if you feel like
it. Wow, is that right? If you feel like it.
Yeah.
So you have the option to not even try it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I had nothing to lose. It was going to be my last competition ever. And so I figured it's my last competition ever. I might as well. And so I threw it. And I actually, normally I'd have a nice view of the ceiling when I do a jump like that. But this time I was standing on 1 foot. Perfectly landed triple salchow. It's like,
tell me about this, because okay. You're talking language now that I've seen and they say it, but I'm too uneducated to even ask a question about it?
Well, a triple jump, like it goes up from doubles to triples. So doubles are when you rotate twice in the air, and then triples are three times in the air.
So what's the axle part of it?
The axle is an only forward takeoff, so that adds a half a revolution to the jump, which makes it a little harder.
So you jump forward but land backwards?
Yeah. You always land backwards.
So it's three and a half.
The jumps are always the same in the air, and they always land the same, so nobody can tell the difference between the jumps. It's the takeoff that makes them different.
Either backward or forward. And the axle, you start forward and land backward.
Yep.
And so to land a triple axle.
Yeah, three and a half turns. That's hard.
Is it?
Not anymore. I mean, the guys, you can't even get out of juniors without a triple axle. It's quads.
Four times.
And there's guys that can do almost every takeoff with a quad. There's six different takeoffs. And each one of them has its own challenges.
When you were landing your triple, though, was that a huge deal to the entire community?
It was kind of where a lot of the guys in the event were doing triples, but I was able to kind of entertain a little bit, and I was probably a little bit better with handling music and all. Even though I was clueless about most things, in that competition, I landed the triple sow, and I got through the rest of the program clean, and I won junior nationals.
So the year before, you were
seventh,
and then you won, and so you get to stay. You get a sponsor? Is that what happened?
Well, what happened was a coach saw that I was winning junior nationals. He goes, I can get him a sponsor if he'll come coach with me or take from me. And so the coach that year coached Dorothy Hamill and John Curry to Olympic gold medals. So I was in pretty good hands. So I just moved to Denver. I was sponsored. I turned 18 that summer. And the next year was my first year on the senior level. And I returned to my old days of glory. I wiped up the ice and then came in ninth. And what was bad about that was the last time my mom ever saw me skate. And so the morning that I lost her, and she was, everything to me. She was the center of my universe, everything. I love this woman. I just decided that from then on, I was going to honor her sacrifice, and I was going to be the person that she thought I could be. And so I took her with me wherever I went. I was always accountable to her. And if I was on the ice, I worked harder than I've ever worked. And ended up getting a really difficult triple that summer that I was so horrific in the previous nationals. And I went from being ninth at nationals to third at nationals and then 11th in the world. And then 2 years later, I'm on the Olympic team.
So when you won the gold, was that your first Olympics in 84?
80.
So 80. So
I came in fifth. That was a finish first for me.
That's what I was going to ask. So you go to the Olympics in 80. Like, that's got to be a thing. You talk about your mom. That's got to be a thing, too, where you're like, man, like you just did well.
Yeah.
Did you? And in fifth, little did you know 4 years
later.
No,
I wanted to be eighth. I thought if I came in eighth, that's a win. That's a gigantic.
How many guys are there?
And I don't even remember. I was the third guy on a three-man U.S. team. So.
Why eighth? What was significant about the eighth?
I did the math, and I looked at all the other skaters, and I thought if I could beat just enough guys, I could come in eighth. I never anticipated coming in fifth, ever. And then I went to Worlds right after that, and I came in fifth again. And so a month later, I woke up to have breakfast, and the top three guys all retired. So all I had to do was wake up one morning, and I'm ranked second in the world. And from then on, it was like, okay, what do I got to do in order to win? And that was, you hate compulsory figures. You have to fall in love with your weakest element. It was only like, I liked doing half the job. I didn't like doing the other half at all. And so I just got to work, and I fell in love with compulsory figures. And I
don't know what compulsory figures is.
They're like the figure eights. Like, if you ever see those figure eights, like when you see people tracing things, like in, they don't even really exist anymore. But back then, that was kind of the foundation of all skating, and they're boring because all you do is you trace circles for hours. And I hated it because it wasn't fun. And so I decided to make it a contest with myself, and I ended up getting pretty good at figures. And I ended up, from October 1980 until March of 1984, I never lost a competition because I figured it out.
You figured what out?
I figured out how to prepare myself to win. And that was after a lot of beta testing and losing. my coach was the perfect coach. I ended up leaving that the Olympic champion coach and going to an unknown coach pretty much in Philadelphia. And he packaged me and he taught me how to discipline myself, and he taught me how to be accountable, and he taught me how to show up every day with a real path to winning. And that summer I won my first international competition, then I went to the Olympics, and then from then on I just never lost.
Tell me about not so much winning the gold, but after you win the gold and you come back home.
Mm-hmm.
Are you famous then?
Well, you know, here's the deal. When I was on my way to Sarajevo, I was in Chicago Airport, and I was reading because we had a long layover, and I just like reading to kind of relax, and I lost track of time. I was like, oh my goodness. I was like half a concourse away from my gate, and I got up, and I asked the guy walking, I go, what time is it? Can you tell me what time is it? And he goes, and he just dissed me and walked away, and I was like, okay, that was unpleasant. I can't get the time of day on my way to the Olympics. It's really rough. And then on the way back, I was in baggage claim, and I ended up getting stuck there for 2 hours signing autographs.
That quick, huh?
No, it's overnight. And
wow.
And then I went back to Denver the next day, and there was a parade through downtown Denver, and it ended up being in Larimer Square. 5,000 people were in Larimer Square to welcome me back.
A parade for you?
Yeah. It's crazy. It was insane. So life changes that quickly. The director of the telecast for ABC was one of the original Why World of Sports guys. You know, his name is Doug Wilson. And he said, oh, by the way, your life is completely different. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I got it. Yeah, right. And I went home. And sure enough, I'd won all those years and nothing really. And then I come back from the Olympics and it's like, oh man, this is really different.
So when you come back and now you're famous, do you start to make a little more money when you come back because of people going, hey, we want to give you a deal, a car, that kind of stuff?
Well, I was broke, I was living in one of my best friend's parents' basement, you know, because I didn't have any money and they just sort of looked after me. And then I got a, first thing was I got an endorsement opportunity for Coca-Cola, and I didn't really want to miss the world championships. And if I took the endorsement, I realized that that's money. Titles are forever. Money is like, it goes really fast. So I said no to Coca-Cola.
So you can't take money because then you can't skate.
That was then. You can now.
Okay, but then?
Then you can't. You couldn't then. So I decided to go to the Worlds because I figured if I win a fourth world title and if I do it in Canada against, you know, my biggest competitor, then, you know, I can kind of like, you know, okay, I'm done. And my first job was with the Ice Capades. And I was with them for 2 years. They went through a sale, and the new owner didn't want any guy skaters, and so I was let go.
So you can work, you just can't take money?
That was during the Olympics. I turned pro right after the World Championships that March. I went pretty much from Worlds to a press conference where I said I'm retiring and I'm up for bid if anybody wants me. And at that point, there wasn't any guys making money in skating, so I had to kind of figure it out. And I had a really good agent. He was with IMG, and I signed with him because I liked him, because I thought he was a pretty humble guy. But he was also representing Chris Evert and my favorite athlete in the world, Bjorn Borg. He was representing him. I go, can I meet him? He goes, absolutely. I go, you're my guy. And he goes,
why Bjorn Borg?
I just loved his temperament. I loved how he always won. And there was something about him that was just, it allowed me to be calm, cool, and collected when I competed, you know, because he was kind of a great role model that way. It's like, you don't have to get all crazy, you can just do your job. And so I signed with Bob, and then he did really well at getting me some work. And then when I was let go from Ice Capades, Bob and I sat down, and he goes, what do you want to do? And I go, well, let me check my calendar.
Wait, they let you go. They fired you from Ice Capades.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want any male skaters.
Right.
They didn't want a gold medal skater.
No.
Did you cost too much, though? Was that just their thing? Like, we don't, but really, it was like, we're paying too much.
Well, you know, they offered me 1 week of shows in Minneapolis, which is the new owner's hometown, for 1/5 what I was making. And I said, I don't really think that's a good idea because I've got this other opportunity to build a tour. It's my tour. And he goes, where's your loyalty? And it's like, oh, good question. So I started a show called Stars on Ice, and it's still going. I mean, it was great.
You started Stars on Ice?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That
was a lot of hard work. It was, I was unloading trucks when crews didn't show up, and I was doing everything possible to keep this thing alive.
Wow. So you started that, and it's doing its thing now.
Yeah, I don't own it. I just started it. I founded it with IMG. IMG doesn't really partner with clients. So I said, you know, hey, just give me half the show, and you don't have to pay me anything until it's profitable. And they're like, nah, we don't really want to do that. And it's still out. It's still going. I just hosted the NBC television special, Stars on Ice in Orlando, about a month ago, and it's a really good show. I'm really proud of the skaters.
I was reading as I was watching the Olympics, and because I grew up in Arkansas, we had a brief winter. There was no hockey, and I grew up very poor. There was no ice anything.
No.
You know, and unless you're in a region where the ice already exists, it costs a lot of money to get to ice, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, if I lived in Colorado, I wouldn't need to be rich to ski. But because I lived in Arkansas, you had to be rich to ski because you weren't getting
ski. It's called access barriers.
Yeah, yeah. So huge access barriers. Yeah. So I didn't know anything. And I'm learning about hockey because the Preds, you know, over the last 5 or 6 years. I'm watching the Winter Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm watching the ice skating. And what was there drama with you and the new broadcast team? They were making it into a whole story.
No. What happened was this reporter from the New York Times sat me down at the U.S. Figure Skating Championships in San Jose, and she goes, I want to know how you feel about this change, because I was the lead analyst for NBC for 4 Olympics and 3 with NBC.
Wow.
So when Johnny and Tara did all this stuff in Sochi, they just, you know, Johnny was really being outrageous.
He wears the loud clothing,
crazy stuff.
Right? Okay.
But it got to be such a huge deal that they're like, oh, yeah, we need to bring those guys up. And so when I left Sochi, I thought, I'm done. I'm never going to do another Olympics. And then they reached out and they said, we're going to move you out of the lead commentary position and we're going to bring them up. And I go, I figured that was going to happen. I'm a smart guy. I can see where the tides are going. And I go, well, and they go, we want to keep you. And I go, oh, why? And they go, well, because, you know, you've done a good job for us. We want to keep you around. And so the New York Times reporter was trying to, we talked for a long time. She was grilling me and she was waiting for me to crack and say, this is a horrible thing. And I go, you know what? I'm there by their invitation. It's not my job. It's theirs to give. And you know what? When they told me I wasn't going to be the lead analyst anymore, for about 10 minutes, I was kind of like mourning, you know, kind of what was. And after that, it's like, all right, let's see what happens next. And so they brought me to every Nationals from there on to be kind of like the voice of, I don't know, historical perspective or whatever, or to get to the heart of what the competition was. And then I went to the Olympics and they gave me an hour-long pregame show called Olympic Ice on NBCSN. It was a blast and I loved it. And I got to go to the events and watch and not have to be under the pressure of having to come up with things to say. And it was really great to be able to appreciate that and be able to talk about it the next day. So, you know, change is going to happen.
It doesn't
inevitable.
Sound like as much drama as Twitter. Because I was reading it and I was like, dry. You know, I don't know enough about it.
Yeah.
Like I've said, I don't know enough about the Winter Olympics. That doesn't sound as dramatic as they try to make the clickbait.
No. Well, and then with the New York Times article was, you know, I was demoted and don't feel sorry for me. And that was basically what I said. I go, I'm great. I get to be at another Olympics. So I did this last Olympics, and I was on NBCSN, and, you know, the audience there is much smaller because it's a cable kind of situation, and one of the guys that was kind of with us was one of the NBC executives that goes, we're not allowed to talk to talent about ratings, and I go, well, you don't have to, I don't want to know, I don't really care, it's not going to change my job at all, I'm going to do the same work, and he goes, you're doing 5 times bigger rating than any show that's ever been on this network, and it's like, okay, okay, yeah, great.
What do you do with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, no, nothing. And I thought, well, that's really nice. People are, you know, we're at least not underperforming, you know, and so that's good. So we just did our job, and then about 3 weeks after I got back, I got a call from NBC, and they want me to do another 4 years.
Wow, is that right?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's like, you don't know. It doesn't always have to be exactly the way it always was for it to be enjoyable. I had a blast in Pyeongchang. I really did. I loved my work. All I did was work. I would do the event in the morning. I'd do the show and then watch the event, and then I go to practice and watch some practices, and then I go back, grab dinner, then go to my room and watch YouTube videos, go through all the protocols of all the marks they've gotten all year, write down every note, go over the show format. Go to bed. That was my existence. Wow. At the Olympics. And it was awesome because when I first got there, and it was kind of wild, I was panicking. I couldn't sleep because I don't know enough stuff. Like, I don't, there's no way in the world I'm going to be labeled a fraud because I don't know enough stuff to get through an hour of television every day for a month. And then I looked over and my book was, because I took it to kind of start promoting it, my book was like sitting up staring right at me, and it's like, yeah, get to work. So I got to work, and it was, I used everything that I put in the book, and it was like, it works. Like, it got me through that Olympics really well, and I got another 4 years.
Let me talk about one of our sponsors here for a second. So here's this. If there's a vulnerability, cyber crooks can find it. Recently, hackers accessed a smart thermometer at a casino to hack into their database of high rollers. Information stolen may have included private details of the casino's biggest spenders. It's just people's private information. They hacked a thermometer. Man, there are so many threats in today's connected world. It just takes one weak link. Criminals can get right in there. Good thing new LifeLock Identity Theft Protection adds the power of Norton Security to help protect against threats to your identity and to your devices that you can't easily see or fix on your own. If you have a problem, they have agents who will work to fix it. No one can stop every cyber threat, prevent all identity theft, or monitor transactions at all businesses. But new LifeLock with Norton Security is able to uncover threats that you might otherwise miss. Go to LifeLock.com or call 1-800-LifeLock and use the promo code BONES for an additional 10% off your first year. Yeah, promo code is BONES. LifeLock.com, promo code BONES for an additional 10% off. So you were talking about going to, how do you say it, Pyeongchang?
Mm-hmm.
You're in South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make you nervous that North Korea is just right at the time? And, you know, the news has got tensions. And
well, the thing is, yeah, if you're here, the news tells you that, you know, like, and going into Sochi, Jack and Jill, the terrorists, are going to disrupt the Olympics. People are going to die. Well, I was scared to death. And then I got there and I looked around. It's like, okay, we're good. You know, it's the same thing with, you know what our security was at the, they call it the coastal cluster. And the coastal cluster was all the indoor buildings for curling, speed skating, figure skating, hockey. They were all in this big cluster with a couple sponsor houses and a big superstore. And that was the coastal cluster. And then all the television trucks and everything to cover the events. That was all in this coastal cluster. So going through security every single morning, we had to go in through bag and mag type of thing. And our security was three college girls.
That sounds like my kind of security right there.
No, but I mean, no, but it's like there was no machine guns, no dogs, no, like, you know, there was no snipers on the roofs. Or it was just
chill.
It's
the opposite of what we would expect by what we're seeing.
And the North Koreans were everywhere. Everywhere you looked, you saw the North Korean cheerleaders. The little pair team that was from North Korea were so warmly appreciated by the audience, and they were really good. And then they marched in together under the same flag. How much trouble are we going to have here, really? I mean, come on.
So you felt no threat?
None. Like, and it's almost the point where now I can't even watch the news anymore. I just can't, because there's nothing real about it. It's just, it's almost like they're trying to hook you. And remember the old soap operas? Did you ever watch any of those old soap operas?
My mom would.
Yeah. So back in the day when I was training, I would go from 7 in the morning till about noon, and then I'd go make myself lunch, and then I'd watch a couple hours of soap operas to relax because I was resting for the night stuff. And, you know, I would realize that I'd leave to go to competition, and I'd go, oh, I hate to miss this week because there was so much that was going to happen. And I came back, and it was all nothing happened.
It's
the same with the news cycle. It's like, you know, you come back, and it's like, oh, yeah, they're still talking about that, and nothing's really changed. So I don't really want to waste my time anymore, you know, because it's all meant to kind of also, if you watch like CNN or MSNBC or Fox, they all have a different point of view.
And you have to have a radical opinion.
And that's it.
And I don't have radical opinions. Yeah. I have opinions, but they're not radical.
No.
And if you're not just upset, it's almost like you don't have a voice. Like, the voices that are heard are the ones that are, I'm so left, I'm so right. That's all there is that exists. And you feel like you have to be a part of that. And it brings people to it.
Yeah.
Like, I see people gravitate to the polar sides because they feel like they're supposed to be on a side.
Yeah.
And I'm going, you don't have to do that.
No.
I'm not like that.
Like, I live here, and I'll go to West Coast or New York, and it's a completely different population, a completely different point of view, a completely different sensitivity. It's like, wow, this is really happening in this country. And there's no reason. You know, it's like when I was in Sochi, we went to lunch at this really expensive place. It was on the mountain. I had one day to go up to the mountain. We went up, we found this restaurant. It was the restaurant to go to. And it was me and one of the lead producers from NBC. And then next to us was three Russian guys and a Korean guy. And it was a Korean guy's 50th birthday. So they're all, you know, And the Russian guy, we're talking, he's big personality, he's big burly guy, and he goes, let me ask you something. And I go, and he goes, when you were a little boy, we're about the same age, right? And I go, I think so. And he goes, did they teach you to fear us, Russians? And all I could think of was, duck and cover, you know, because the bombs are coming.
Like the Cold War.
Yeah. And I go, yeah, they did, pretty much. And he goes, when I was a little boy, yeah, right, probably same like you, bells would ring and the teachers would scream at us, get down in the basement, the Americans are coming to destroy us. Mm. He goes, isn't it amazing that you and I in just minutes can become friends and our leaders act like children? And I was like, "Ooh, bingo!" Yeah. You know, it's so I don't want to get political or anything,
but it's just a cycle.
Yeah, it's meant to, it's to, you know, kind of dopamine and all that other stuff and the colors they use, all that. It just seems so phony to me that I can't participate. I just can't.
It makes me tired too because everyone wants my opinion on things.
Yeah,
I just did this long 3-4 hour interview with a magazine that say, how do you feel politically? And I have no problem talking about my politics. People just don't come to me for my politics. Like there's a difference.
Yeah.
If you want to ask
me. I'm an entertainer.
Yes. If you want to ask me, like I will tell you, but I'm not going to get on my radio show
and
say, and so they say, hey, did you vote for Donald Trump? And I said, I did not. I said, but I think he's done some things that are good. And I also think he's done some things that aren't good. And they were just shocked that someone could say both things inside the same paragraph.
Yeah.
I said, that position will never just be, no one's going to be perfect or awful. Yeah, and I said, I think he's done some fantastic and some really terrible things.
But who is perfect and who's awful?
And
right?
That's my point. And, and they were so stunned that I didn't just jump on one side and go, hur, or woo.
Yeah.
They're like, wow, no one, either they don't talk about it or they pick a side.
Yeah.
No one ever goes, you know, actually, there's some duality in this.
Yes. And, you know, it's crazy. And that's why all I really want to do is encourage people.
And you are Mr. I'm going to tell you, when you're not here, you're so inspirational.
Oh,
you come in this show or just, let's say, Amy's Kitchen, and we talk. I leave from talking to you and I'm like, man, I'm so inspired.
Oh, thanks. Like,
and not just because of your story, but when you were a kid, how old were you? Because didn't you have an illness that you couldn't diagnose it and you didn't grow?
I didn't grow for about 4 years.
So what was that?
Well, they couldn't figure it out, and they couldn't figure it out. And then I started skating, and then all of the symptoms went away. And then in 2004, I had cancer in 97, which was chemo and surgery and all that stuff. And then in 2004, I'm diagnosed with a brain tumor. And it's like, oh, come on. I did the other thing, right?
So as a kid, and then you get testicular cancer.
Yeah.
And then you get a brain tumor.
Right. So I joke that I'm going to be much, much more well-known for my collection of life-threatening illness than I ever did anything on the ice, right? But here's the crazy thing was when they went in and they did the biopsy, you have to dig a hole in your skull and go through and take a piece. And they came back and they handed my wife all the information on the brain tumor. And Tracy goes, oh, listen to this. Craniopharyngiomas are usually detected early in a child's life. I was born with this brain tumor. Due to a lack of growth and development.
Mm. Huh.
And so it's like, see, now if you live long enough, all questions will be
answered.
You can
figure it out.
Yeah. So they're all trying to go, why did it stop? And maybe it was when I crashed Gary Wachter's bike into the telephone pole. Maybe I just, you know, the brain tumor just got pummeled or something. I don't know. You know, it's just, we don't know how things happen. But for those years that I skated, I didn't have any of the symptoms anymore, but the second I stopped, the brain tumor showed itself, and it was like, wow, that's crazy.
And so the last time you were here, I think you had been maybe 2016, it's been a year and a half since you've been in. Did they re-diagnose, like they found
Yeah, there's another one. Yeah, 2004 was radiation. It came back in 2010, surgery, and then it came back in 2016. Do we have a pattern here? You know, it's like, yuck, this is gonna be every 6 years. But this time I just sort of tapped the brakes and I just said, you know what, I just, something in me is just telling me to get strong. And I didn't know if it was physical, mental, emotional, spiritual. I had no idea. So I decided, yes, I'm gonna get strong every way I possibly can get strong. And I just cut out things in my diet. I added some things that were more, you know, healthy, and I just, you know, I just got to work, and I went back for the first scan, and they said it hasn't grown. And I'm like, wow, that's miraculous. And I go, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. So I kept doing what I was doing. I went back months later, and they pulled me in. They go, it shrunk. And I go, has one ever shrunk before without treatment? And they go, no. And I go, can you explain that? And they go, God, I don't know. And I go, okay, that's good enough for me. So it was wild. I mean, my endocrinologist had the same brain tumor as me, taken out, the same surgery, same surgeon, everything when she was 14, only became an endocrinologist because she was underserved. And my first visit with her, she changed all my meds, and I felt like a normal person in 4 days. It was perfect. It was unbelievable. And I called her, and I go, have you ever heard of a craniopharyngioma shrinking without treatment? She goes, no. Okay. Then I went on the Dr. Oz show, and I'm like talking to him, and I go, you know what a craniopharyngioma is, right? And he goes, of course I do. I go, have you ever heard of one that shrank without treatment? He goes, never. So then I went back months later, and it shrunk again. It's insane. No one can explain it. But it's like, I'm so grateful that I get a pass. Like, I don't have to deal with it like I haven't. It's really invasive, and it's your brain, right? So you don't want anybody touching it. And so I'm just, you know, just trying to stay in my lane and you know, again, trying to be light and encourage people and do the best I can to advance cancer research and to do good while I'm here. You know, I'd much rather do that than, you know, anything else. You know, I've got a great wife. I've got phenomenal, healthy kids. And if this is something I have to take on so they don't get it, I'm okay with that too. So, you know, here we are.
So tell me, after you come out of your first brain surgery, do you start to go, let me see what I feel? Do I feel the same?
I knew. First, because what happens with radiation is radiation goes through your whole brain. And I really feel like sometimes I'm in a fog. You know, I had chemo, and you get chemo brain from that, you know, where you can't remember things. And, you know, I'll be talking about somebody I've known for 20 years, and it's like, oh, what's his name? And I'll do that, right? And so I remember, you know, kind of how I was before radiation, and I feel like I've lost more than a step, you know, but I'm still here, and that's great. And I'm still doing the work to advance the science so that, you know, there isn't so much collateral damage as the status quo, you know. And so that's why, you know, CARES is CARES. That's my cancer foundation. And I'm going to continue to do the work until, you know, we can fund enough science to change the game. And right now there's enough science out there that, you know, it's the game is being changed. You know, CAR T therapy, which is a immunotherapy, is working on lymphoma, and we just need to create more for every kind of cancer.
Mr. Inspiration. That's why I call you. Never to your face. Well, never. And it's rare someone calls you something behind your back that's better than what they would call you to your face.
I've been called a lot of things to my face.
Man. Well, okay. So the book, check out the book, Finish First, Winning Changes Everything. The true story is, when I started your book, I had to stop because I was writing my book, and I was like, whoa, we're too similar.
Yeah. Computer virus.
You can't.
Yeah, and put it down.
You'll pick stuff up, and I do this in stand-up. You'll pick stuff up and not know you picked it up until someone goes, ooh, that's similar. And you go, no, it's not, but secretly you go, oh, it is. So I didn't.
Put it down. No. It's good.
But
I'll read yours.
I'm done now, I can get back to it.
Oh, okay.
But great. I did have to stop, and I would be honest with you. I would say, I finished it in life.
That was a great TED Talk. It really was.
Oh, thanks. You know, I just feel like I've only learned because I've lost a lot.
Yeah.
You know, you tell your stories about falling. I feel like that's, you know, my whole life. And people see the glamour of it all and go, oh, you're good at something. So you're at the top. No way, man. Do you know how many times I sucked? All the times.
Yeah.
Like, winning is not glamorous. No. The only part of glamour is that you get to see the Instagram picture or the on TV part or the, you know, and so.
But if you're rooted in that, you know, if you're rooted in the idea that this came out of a lot of that, it has so much more value, you know, because you worked through it. You didn't give up. You didn't allow your conditions to knock you down.
We're stronger once we get to
100%.
To maintain.
100%.
You know, it's like some of these kids, these viral kids or these people that get on a TV show, all of a sudden they're thrust up and they didn't put all. It's not the fact that they didn't put the work in to get there. It's that they don't have the work ethic embedded into them to continue at that level.
Yeah.
More so than it is.
Well, and then, you know, all the other stuff. You know, I tell people all the time that we're wired for challenge much more than good fortune, you know, because I've seen so many people that are, you know, given really horrific situations, and they rise up and they're better than that, stronger, more in touch than everything they've ever been. And then you see people that come across great fortune all at once, you know, whether it be in entertainment or winning the lottery or whatever. And all of a sudden, all those demons come flying out and they're doing things that they never could have imagined doing back when they were, you know, fighting so hard to, you know, kind of just stay alive. So, you know, I'll encourage anybody that's going through it right now. I mean, if you're really struggling, you're way better off than if you're just at that, at, you know, standing on the podium, shaking your fist right now without all that other stuff that allows you to be fortified for that moment. Because once you hit that moment, man, it changes everything, yeah, you know?
I agree. I couldn't do what I do now at the level and with the sincerity that I do it now without all the crap that happened to me before.
Yeah.
And without me being able to have the sincerity that I have, I wouldn't be able to maintain it.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful. What I used to look at as a setback, I now see as a strength.
Yeah.
Because I go, oh, woe is me. You know, my mom died early. I was raised by my grandma. I was adopted. Like, you know, like, yeah. You, I feel bad. But then you go, do you know all the strength I've gathered from that?
Yes. Yeah.
And that's why I'm staying where I am.
Mm-hmm.
And it's made me a better person.
Do you know, have you ever heard of Barry Gibb's First Fame thing?
Mm-mm. So from the Bee Gees.
Barry Gibb,
yeah.
The last remaining brother of the Bee Gees. You know, he just said, first fame, if you can survive first fame, you're going to be great. It's just getting through that first taste of all of that coming at you. If you can survive that, you're probably going to be okay. And I was blessed that when I came home from that Olympics, you know, I get the parade and all this other
That's
stuff.
Crazy, by the way.
the governor of Colorado called me into his office, and I thought it was, you know, I'm in my jacket and tie. I thought it was a photo op, you know. And I walk in, and there was a guy in the office with him, and he goes, just wait outside. I'm just going to talk to Scott. And he gave me a lecture on hometown hero syndrome. He said, you know, I go, what is that? And he goes, it's when you're the captain of the quarterback of the high school football team, and you throw that strike into the end zone to win the state championship, and everybody carries you off the field on their shoulders, and you expect the rest of your life to be that way. He says, I don't want that to happen to you. I just want to make you aware of it. Enjoy the fruits of your labor. Enjoy everything that comes to you, but I want you to know that it will end someday. And when it does, I want you to be prepared for it. And I just think about what a generous gift that was at that time in my life. And it's like, wow, I think about that all the time. It's like, yeah, all this go away in a heartbeat, all of it. And that's okay, because that's supposed to be my journey. But I'm going to work as hard as I can to do everything I can until that moment happens.
We shall say no more. I shall leave inspired yet again. Well, Scott, it's always a pleasure, my friend.
You're a good man. Thanks for doing this. Thanks for having me on.
Are you kidding me? I've been trying to get you on for, we've been bouncing and you're out of town, I'm out of town. Like, I've been looking forward to this one for months. We've been trying to do this for months.
Well, you know, let me know how I can help you in any way, shape, or form. And I'm here to serve.
You got a 50? You got a
50
spot?
I do. Yeah.
All right, Scott Hamilton. Check out the book, Finish First. And wow. There you go. There you go. Another episode. I appreciate your time. That's an hour. We did an hour.
Wow.
Yeah, look at us.
I was going, how are you going to edit that?
There's no editing.
Oh, man.
This is all.
It is go.
Straight up. All right. Thank you. We'll see you next time on the Bobbycast.